Good morning, members of CEDA. Tom Baddeley, State Director, Deirdre Wilmot, Premier's Chief of Staff. I'd like to acknowledge Anne Nolan, Director General of the Department of State Development, Rob Jeffries, the CEO of the Geraldton Iron Ore Alliance. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet today, the Noongar people, and my respect for their beliefs. I will introduce the Oakajee Port and Rail supply chain to you this morning by setting out some key facts about the project, describing the technical and commercial steps which will be taken between now and the commencement of commercial operations. I will spend a little time on a description of the works to be undertaken, the contract packages which will be let, and the procurement process which we will adopt to procure this project. I'll also reflect on the strategic importance of the project to the Midwest region, and in this context discuss the importance of the state and federal government funding. I will also reflect on the opportunities which this project presents Western Australia for regional engagement, the models which can be drawn upon to further and deepen that engagement, and the benefits which such engagement will generate for the economies with significant complementarities, such as those of Western Australia and our trading partners. But first, some key facts about the project. As many of you will know, Oakajee is located some 23 kilometres north of Geraldton on a site with an ancient paleo channel, which is the form of the old Oakajee River, at a very high energy location on the west coast. Sea state presents certain key challenges, but there are also key benefits, one of which is the very significant Oakajee industrial estate immediately located inland of the site. Unlike most ports in Australia, and certainly most ports in Western Australia, even some of the more recent ports, there is no pattern of residential settlement around Oakajee, and this provides a unique opportunity for business to take full advantage of what clearly is an important industrial site. The site is also well served by the town of Geraldton, which offers a very high degree of residential amenity and skilled labour. The supply chain comprises approximately 550 kilometres of rail route to the northeast to transport iron ore from mines in the Jack Hills Weld Range region, and to connect mines in the south operated by Jindalby, Mount Gibson, Asia Iron and others. The initial configuration of the materials handling gear at the port will be approximately 35 million tonnes per annum with a Pilbara-style car dumper, stacker reclaimer, stockpiles, conveyors and a 10,000 tonne per hour ship loader. This represents a very substantially different materials handling configuration from that presently in existence at Geraldton. Associated facilities such as iron ore stockpiles, rail operations maintenance facilities, a desalination plant, lump re-screening will also be provided. Total project costs to date have been estimated to approximately $4 billion Australian dollars, 2.4 in the rail, 1.6 in the port, which in turn is divided approximately 800 in sea-based marine works, comprising the breakwater and dredging, and approximately 800 for the land-based materials handling and port-related rail works. In preparation for the speech today, I asked my accounting team to pull together the costs which have been incurred to date in getting to where we are today. Feasibility costs to date have been approximately $60 million. With an estimated additional work over the next 12 to 18 months, of a further $100 million. This budgeted expenditure will be met by the OPR participants, not by the state government. And significant expenditure is planned for the finalisation of rail engineering, geotech and environmental work, in particular, which will form the basis of a definition of the rail network. Now, in getting into some detail, the capital costs of the rail and the bulk of the rail expenditure is represented in the following key contract packages. Below formation works for the rail route probably would be constructed on four fronts, three to four fronts, including temporary and demountable accommodation camps located at various points along the rail route. We propose, subject to speaking obviously to our contractors, that there would probably be a culverts team, a bridges team, teams devoted to roads and crossings, track laying and supply, early procurement of sleepers, signals and comms, and rail yard and workshops, very substantial physical investment. Capital expenditure at the port, represented by the following key contract packages: breakwater from locally mined armour rock, most of which has been located already in the industrial estate areas, dredging, and other works comprising tugs and small boat harbours and general infrastructure, including navigation aids. The private use infrastructure at the port will be the inloading and outloading circuits for materials handling gear, comprising the train unloading facilities, stockyards, lumpery screenings, stacker reclaimers, ship loaders and berths. All of you with experience in these disciplines will be required to lend a hand to this project, and it's a project where we intend to the maximum extent to have as much as we can local engagement. The procurement method, how are we going to go about this? Well, it'll be no surprise to all of you that the procurement method which we are obliged to adopt will be competitive tender. But that's not because of government involvement in relation to the common use infrastructure. Quite apart from government involvement, the common use infrastructure is essential to ensure that our capital costs incurred qualify for our regulated asset base as part of our regulated tariff calculations. You see, Okajee Port and Rail is a monopoly service provider, and as such we fall to be regulated by the Economic Regulatory Authority of WA under the Rail Access Act and the Rail Access Code, just the same as WestNet. But in order to ensure that our tariffs are approved by that authority, we have to demonstrate that those costs have been incurred efficiently. The best way to do that is by competitive tender of the costs themselves. Before we can commence letting tenders for the execution of the works, we have to plan the execution of those works to ensure we fully understand the key risks and issues in the development of the supply chain. And it's around this question of the investigation of key risks that we have spent a lot of time over the last 12 months. During an extensive series of risk workshops conducted during our tender to the WA government last year and at the end of last year, we have determined that probably one of the most important risks for OPR to fully understand is the detail of the transportation task that's actually required in the Midwest. And although you would think that is relatively straightforward because we're shipping iron ore, what this actually requires is a thorough understanding of the mine's products, volumes, timing, and tonnages. I don't want to be invested too early, nor can I be invested too late. I am required to provide a service to the mines, and therefore coordinating with mine development is absolutely fundamentally important. So when you start to turn your mind to the question of what mine products will be coming forth out of the Midwest, you need to understand what is entailed in cargo assembly. Where will that assembly occur? Will the cargoes be assembled at the mine or at the port? And what value creation opportunities exist for the service or infrastructure providers to assist mines in cargo assembly? Several mines in the Midwest are still conducting or are yet to conduct their BFS bankable feasibility study programs. When this information is to hand, we'll be able to respond with tariff profiles and options for the mines to finalise their plans, including cut-off grades and pit designs, because until we can deliver tariffs to the mines, the mines can't complete their total costs of production. To assist, OPR is presently conducting a tender for the appointment of the role of Project Management Services Contractor, and I know that some of you in the audience are participating in this tender. This is an important appointment which will be essentially a role to manage and complete the remaining engineering designs and estimating work required to take our bankable feasibility study to the required degree of accuracy acceptable to capital markets such as John and his bank, our sponsors, and of course the government. We expect that CapEx, OpEx estimates will be put through a gateway process early in March next year prior to its progression into tender of key contract packages and early FEED or front-end engineering and design. Now, specifically the timetable, and I know I'm going to regret saying this as soon as I say it, but people have told me I have to talk about timetables, so here it comes. As you know, we signed the development agreement in March this year. This was absolutely essential for us to undertake the necessary further expenditure to complete the planning phase, an additional $100 million. However, in May this year, in the next few weeks, we'll complete some value engineering studies. We'll commence our BFS with the appointment of our PMSC in mid-2009. We will hope to secure the definition of the rail corridor and land access for investigation studies by mid this year, with the completion of our BFS studies by March 2010. Front-end engineering and design would commence almost immediately thereafter, as would early procurement, some long lead time items, contracts for which would be let around September 2010. Targeting a financial close on the project in late 2010, commencement of construction early 2011, with project completion targeted for the end of 2013. Now, a lot has been said in various places about the business planning process which this project requires and which is going on. I can assure you the business planning process for this project is a very formal and well-considered process where we've had the benefit of a number of professional advisors and consultants. The business planning process through which the project must pass to assemble a business case for investment by capital markets is one which demonstrates first technical and then financial and commercial feasibility. The bid process through which OPR passed last year required us to develop a preliminary business case and bid it as part of our proposal. This was done on a series of assumptions into which we are now engaged in detailed investigation. We develop our business case on the basis of technical and commercial facts and then investigate any assumptions that are required to be made. Commercially, this requires, among many other things, that we benchmark our supply chain performance around Australia, and I can tell you it was a very interesting study which we commissioned as part of our bid process. We did this with the purposes of identifying those supply chains which could be regarded as world's best practice and those where, let's say, that there have been sufficient and important lessons learned. What this involved, quite frankly, was a comparison between the Pilbara and Dalrymple Bay. How to do it professionally and successfully, and how, quite frankly, not to do it. From these studies emerged the importance of one key fact which I have been raising for a long time ever since, and that is the importance that people view this project as an integrated supply chain, not a fragmented supply chain. So important to the economic and commercial feasibility, not only of the project, but to be able to deliver the economies of scale which our mine customers require. There are various aspects of integration of the rail and port systems that impacted on the efficiency of the supply chain as a whole and which had to be optimised for the purposes of delivering this competitively priced transport service. One aspect is the supply chain must be flexible. It must be flexible enough to manage variability. Now, variability in the supply chain occurs at both ends. Variations in berth utilisation through managing uncertainty around vessel presentations, particularly having regard to the sea state at Oakajee, and variations in the quality and specification of ore bodies encountered by the mines, which affect cargo assembly. Here in particular, Pilbara supply chains provide a good example of how to manage out ore variability by taking full advantage of blending opportunities at the train loading, unloading, materials handling and ship loading phases of delivery. Cargo assembly opportunities to assist in managing product specifications arise at every step in the supply chain, and this is facilitated by the transport services provider. We intend to offer this facility to our mines should they wish to avail themselves of it. However, this did mean that it was more likely to deliver greater efficiencies to mines and greater opportunities to minimise demurrage if there was an integrated and not a fragmented supply chain. However, the analogy with the Pilbara can only be taken so far in the context of OPR, because we are a regulated open access infrastructure provider, regulated to ensure access in the supply chain is available to all access seekers. So this means that we had to work within a regulatory framework which ensures access requirements are met, but which seek to emulate the efficiencies of fully integrated systems. In striking this balance, we understand that we are a monopoly services provider. But we believe that this is essential in the Midwest to avoid duplicative and inflationary fragmentation of the supply chain and to ensure mine customers are protected in terms of access. We have agreed that we would provide a negotiate arbitrate model to the state government. Details of this model will be available on our website shortly. However, to avoid confusing schemes of regulation, we chose very early to adopt an access framework based on the current Western Australian rail access regime. This governs access and handling from mines gate to ships rail under a handling regime which mirrors the applicable legislation already in place to govern rail. In the regulation of the supply chain, we sought to ensure principles reflected the regulatory regime given effect to while stimulating the efficiencies of the Pilbara. And this is not an easy task when you remember that we have different mines with different equity ownerships and different products and different financiers to be served throughout the region. In moving forward from bid to implementation, timing of the development program is absolutely critical. Several mines have different development timetables. Some, such as Jindalby, are well developed. Others are still at the proof of concept stage, while others are still highly prospective. Complex and difficult choices lie ahead in coordinating the development timetable of the mines, not only among themselves, but with respect to the infrastructure. And there is some complexity in providing regional transport and materials handling solution, which minimises stranded investment, particularly given the different timetables for mine development, but which at the same time promotes long-term efficient cost. But, ladies and gentlemen, promoting long-term and efficient cost is indeed our goal. And we are striving to assist the mines achieve their development timetable while balancing short-term pragmatism and expediency with long-term efficiency. In doing this, we and the mines are driven fundamentally by the offtake market for product, which in the end is the market which pays all our bills. Our overarching long-term objective is to fundamentally ensure regional competitiveness. Competitiveness with other world-class efficient producers, which we often don't see in physically, but which are always present, namely domestic Chinese production and increasing South American production, which is in turn taking advantage of huge economies of scale with new types of seaborne vessel transport. This regional competitiveness will be achieved through an understanding of the mine's position on the international supply cost curve, but also a recognition that the costs of transport FOB Okajie will be a large part, if not the single largest component, of their unit cost. So, against that background, and with a need for an integrated supply chain, the design, documentation, engineering, procurement, financing and operation of the project, its commercial appraisal of the project goes through several stages and iterations. Importantly, we believe the design and construction will respond to market demand. It must not lead demand. Foundation customers will receive the most competitive transport terms for making fixed early capacity commitments where they can. Where they cannot, additional costs may be expected, as such must reflect the enhanced risk. I therefore invite, indeed call on, mill customers of Midwest Mines to firm up their product requirements to be able to take advantage of lowest possible costs, as it will be that which enables those mines to take advantage of the lowest possible transportation tariff. So I guess I'm doing a bit of a sales pitch and I'm looking at Garrett while I'm saying this, but expansion capacity will never be cheaper than foundation customer capacity. My order book is in my pocket and I'll see you outside. Foundation customers and mills will be rewarded for support they provide to underpin the commercial feasibility for the supply chain by tariffs which reflect their commitment. Tariff structures are being modelled at present and a considerable effort is being devoted to mirror the requirements of flexibility around quantities. The problem that I have and the problem that our mines have is mills often have a band around which they can take a variable quantity, so plus or minus 10%, maybe in some cases even more. But that means that the ability of those mines to make capacity commitments to me has to reflect that variation. And this means that our tariff should reflect iron ore industry practice in terms of the offtake contract structure and the transportation arrangements. So by analogy with the power sector, we have a baseline capacity, an intermediate load capacity, and maybe to meet spot market demand, a peaking capacity. And that capacity will be priced accordingly. Flexibility or interruptible volumes will be priced, as will the opportunistic spot market contracts. However, overall, mines can take comfort from the fact that we want to attract a maximum volumes into the system. By maximising our volumes in the system, we drive up utilisation and drive down unit prices. Therefore, the business planning process requires a careful evaluation of all of these project metrics, including those of our customers and their customers. It is not simply a case of adding up the cost. The engineering studies outlined earlier represent only part of the planning activities necessary to complete the planning for the project. And OPR is moving forward to advance, of course, our CapEx and OPEX estimates, but also the regulatory framework, tariff modelling, mine contract negotiations, and our engagement with all communities in the Midwest, in Perth, and in particular our Indigenous communities. All of these disciplines will be reflected in a well-developed business plan. To get where we are today, we've completed our preliminary feasibility study. We've submitted a detailed plan with our proposal in May 2008, against which our status as preferred developer was assessed. But since then, we've carried out a detailed review, executed risk workshops through a formal process, conducted a structured, formal, substantial value engineering study, particularly focused around breakwater design and rail formation works, and completed a planning review. This will be brought together in a gateway process towards the end of May, which when completed will formally mark the commencement of our BFS studies. And this will be carried out to the usual industry practice of plus or minus 15% accuracy with a high degree of probability. I want to turn very quickly now, ladies and gentlemen, to the strategic importance of Oakajee and complete by adding a few words about the international environment within which the project has been developed and moving forward. The strategic importance of Oakajee cannot be overstated. There's plenty of iron ore in the world. It's all over the world. The problem is the lack of infrastructure to bring it to world markets. This importance of transportation services in the Midwest is such that the provision of transportation services obviously now enables existing mines to go from proof of concept to commercial operation, prospective tenements to complete feasibility analysis, and financiers to gain confidence in the long-term commercial competitiveness of the iron ore region. OPR provides this for the Midwest, so it isn't just what OPR is doing today and what we're spending and the parties with whom we're contracting, but it is also, of course, the mines themselves, the mine development programs, and all the employment that that mine expansion program throughout the Midwest will produce. The overall impact of this on the Midwest economy for present and future job growth is, we believe, extremely significant. The connection of the new port to a regional rail network is of huge value to the state, and regional development in Western Australia will be triggered through, at last, the Oakajee industrial estate being able to be connected to a national, perhaps, and even international transportation network. The present state government understands this and have shown significant support for the project. From our point of view, the state's participation in the project advances state's development objectives for the Midwest. It stabilises the provision of finance in capital markets where, at the moment, things are somewhat in flux, and it provides the state with the opportunity to take this project from a multi-product, multi-user port to a multi-product port, because, as you know, I'm interested only in iron ore, and I know that the state has broader concerns than just iron ore. But I guess one thing that occurs to me that the state can do in its investment in this project that I cannot do is the opportunity to encourage increased use of the supply chain through the possibility of concessional wharfage rates, given the natural hedge the state enjoys through state revenue provided by mining royalties. So greater tons across the supply chain obviously means greater royalty revenue for the state. Private sector cannot offer such concessions. OPR is committed to work with the state and the Commonwealth Government to deliver the project in a manner which realises the state's development objectives. And in that respect, I want to talk about the constructive engagement of regional economies through this project. I've been particularly fortunate to work on the project and assist in framing the connection which the project now makes to important regional economies such as Japan, China and Korea. And in my professional life, I've had two major experiences which have influenced my approach and engagement to these questions of regional cooperation in major mining resource projects. The two major influences with which I have worked have been, first of all, the Alcoa Portland smelter in 1982 through 86. This was an incorporated joint venture between Western Mining and the Aluminium Company of America, forming Alcoa of Australia, something I don't need to speak to an audience in Western Australia about. However, in the smelter joint venture in Victoria, the Aluminium Company of America and Western Mining were joined by the Victorian government, CITIC, under their great leader Hu Yaobang at that time. It was the first time CITIC had invested offshore mainland China ever, and a publicly listed resource trust sponsored by an Australian trading bank. Now, that experience provided me, as secretary to that joint venture and general counsel to Alcoa, with considerable detail on a working example of how a major resource project with very different participants and very different objectives can work together to achieve long-lasting commercial success. And we did it in Victoria, and we can do it here in Western Australia. The second experience I had in my professional life, which underscores the importance of constructive regional engagement, is when I worked as special counsel to a body called the APEC Energy Working Group in the mid-1990s. Here I executed a major regional study for APEC Energy, which I presented to a regional meeting of APEC Energy Ministers. This was the first time APEC Energy Ministers had ever met in Sydney. Ever met anywhere, and this was the first time they met in Sydney, and I presented a report on the structures and processes for regional cooperation to facilitate power investment in economies in the region. Interestingly, the conclusions in that study in 1996 are pretty similar to the conclusions today, and that is the same risks in terms of completion, design, construction and operation are viewed in typically the same way by investors in the same capital markets, and if managed in the same way by governments, tend to increase confidence and produce a lower risk-weighted cost of finance. Relatively modest cooperation across international boundaries produced pretty startling economic efficiencies. At that time, Japan's policy of the three E's, energy security, the economic rational use of scarce capital and resources, and environmental protection, informed electricity generation policies throughout the region. Energy security, or resource security as we see it in the Midwest, the rational use of capital and environmental protection guide us still today. Structures and processes for economic regulation of infrastructure investment benefit from regular communication between government sectors and business. So regional cooperation for infrastructure investment didn't begin in APEC in 1996. It actually traces its origins to a thing called the European Coal and Steel Commission, which was created just after World War II in Europe, and through the work of its chief executive, the Belgian Jean Monnet, often referred to as the first statesman of interdependence. Now, the European Coal and Steel Commission ultimately became the forerunner through the Treaty of Rome in the 60s of the Economic Union of Europe today. Interestingly, that started around the need to manage economic growth and prosperity from coal and steel. One major theme of the founders was to obtain regional peace and security through economic interdependence of its sovereign states. And there is no doubt that economic engagement through Okeji with Japan, China and Korea will engage all of those economies in the economy of Western Australia. But what does all this really mean to us here this morning? Well, with the natural resources in Western Australia that we enjoy at present, and in a time of significant economic uncertainty and economic reconstruction, as will be evidenced by announcements made later today in Canberra, but underpinned by the continuing demand for steel in economies such as China and Korea, the hugely important support available from those economies, and know-how and financial support from Japan, and joined with the Western Australian and Australian governments, the Midwest can play an important role in bringing these things together. And the important role it plays is to meet the aspirations for prosperity, employment, and growth through a collaborative approach. Well, we're ready to do our part. How about you? In a recent boardroom discussion, a question was posed: what are we doing now to take full advantage of this almost unprecedented economic situation? And those present from the eastern states said how different it is in Western Australia to find a group asking the question, how will future generations judge us from our efforts today to take advantage of the position we find ourselves in, than complaining about a lack of liquidity and lack of confidence? Will we be seen as intelligently positioning our respective businesses to take full advantage of the undoubted upturn when it will occur by reducing our costs, increasing our competitiveness, and forging important national and international strategic alliances? Or will we sit back and allow this opportunity to pass us by? What better time is there to develop a capital-intensive project such as the OPR supply chain, especially one where our investment horizon is long-term? Thank you for your attention.